I grip on him. I chew my lip and he quirks an eyebrow, waiting.
Can we just run away from home?
His mouth breaks into a grin, eyes flashing mischief.
Sure. Where to? Paris, Madrid. It's summer in Melbourne, you know.
I'm so not used to these surreal sorts of conversations. I know he's playing along with my apprehension, giving me an out he knows I won't take. But if my request was serious, none of these are impossible destinations. A couple of days ago, he asked me about my birthday, which is a month away. In a humorous attempt at subtlety, he brought up cars a half hour later, quizzing me about transmission types and favorite colors. Not quite believing he was seriously considering such an outrageous gift, I mentioned that I won't need a car at Cal.
Yeah, he said, preoccupied with a video game.
I thought that was the end of it until later, sitting at his kitchen table, he asked me how I intended to get around in Berkeley without a car.
Awesome public transportation, and I'm taking my bike.
He paused, a fork full of pasta halfway between his plate and his mouth.
A bike, as in a bicycle?
I laughed.
No, the other kind of bike.
I'm actually a closet Hell's Angel. Wanna go for a spin on my Harley? I squeaked when he pulled me from my chair onto his lap. Hands gripping my waist, he bowed his mouth to my ear and breathed,
"Yes, yes, I do."
And then his father strode into the kitchen, announcing his presence by clattering dishes onto the butcher block island while feigning ignorance of our PDA-laden presence at the table. Now, I tap a finger against my chin and pretend to consider running away from home to Melbourne. If only. I guess I should pack my swimsuit.
Better and better. Do you own a bikini?
Well, no. That single dimple appears at the edge of his lopsided smile.
Then I guess we have some shopping to do first.
He lowers his mouth to mine, just as my dad, who refuses to pretend he doesn't see us, emerges from the hallway to his study and clears his throat.
Well, that went well.
Sarcasm is a favorite line of defense for Reed. I knew Mom and Dad might be inflexible. I couldn't very well expect them to feign delight when they're so opposed to the notion of Reed and me together, but I never thought they'd be openly prejudicial. My altruistic parents urged their daughters to reject racism, bigotry, and intolerance, and our entire lives, Deb and I learned by following their examples. Now I'm facing the fact that their broad-mindedness only exists so long as the individuals aren't famous and affluent. I'm afraid to look up at him, to see how he's dealing with the short, denigrating interview my parents just put him through. He seems remarkably unperturbed by what they said and how they said it. More so than I am. I'm livid and embarrassed. I'm sorry. I didn't know it would be that unpleasant. He chuckles.
Unpleasant, huh?
Understatement?
A bit, yeah.
My parents have gone to their room, leaving the brightly lit living room to us. The soft mumble of their voices signals their open door at the top of the staircase, an unspoken edict that Reed is not to set foot on the stairs, let alone into my bedroom. They weren't this watchful 4 years ago when I was dating Colin, who pretended to be trustworthy and decent, not that I blame them for failing to see through his facade. I just wish they could understand that one of the things I respect about Reed is, oddly enough, the fact that he's honest about who he is and what he wants, no matter what it is. I guess that's why I believe him when he says he wants me. When he says he loves me.
Hey.
He bumps my knee with his and then turns to draw my legs over his and pull me closer.
You okay?
Are you? He half smiles.
Come on now. You don't think I'd let a little parental reproach stand in my way, do you? You know me better than that. I live for disapproval. It's expected of me. My fans would think I was dying or something if parents started randomly approving of me.
Chapter 4. Brooke. Travel is nothing unusual for me. Though getting from one place to another via various airports is tedious as all get out, it's just something to endure. It's not panic-inducing, for Christ's sake. Even so, my flight leaves in 3 hours, and every time I think about landing in Austin, I feel like I'm going to puke. One-wheeled Louis Vuitton bag waits by the front door, and in 10 minutes the other will join it, ready for the car service to transport me to LAX. I've put off calling Reed back, still unused to voluntarily sharing information with him. Doing so borders on trust, something altogether unnatural in conjunction with Reed Alexander. But I said I'd keep him posted, so I dial his number, fully expecting to go to voicemail. Instead, he answers, annoyingly cheerful.
Hey, I was just about to call you.
Balancing the phone between my shoulder and ear, I sweep a load of cosmetics from the vanity counter into a travel bag and zip it shut. You know this is Brooke, right?
I looked this time. Aren't you proud?
What right does he have to be so fucking happy? Oh, yeah, because he's Reed Alexander. Who checks out of any sense of responsibility over anything, ever. Glancing at your screen before answering your phone is a debatable source of pride, Reed, though I guess you have to take it where you find it. He ignores the barb.
So what did you find out?
Am I actually talking to Reed, or has some alien taken over his body? He's too happy to be ill. Though I sure as hell know crazy people can be irrationally happy. Well, Bethany brought a photo of him.
Really? Wow.
And like I told you, he's in foster care. Long-term foster care.
What do you mean, long-term?
The parental rights of his adoptive mother were officially terminated months ago. Her husband died a couple years ago. Bethany's checking on how, not that it matters. It looks like she started using meth after that and didn't care who she took down with her. She's been through court-ordered treatment twice and blew it both times, so she's never getting him back. I think about a 2-year-old River, left with no father and a drug zombie of a mother, and I stuff 2 pairs of jeans into my case with more force than necessary. I don't know where she is now. Jail, crack house, on the streets, hooking for daily hits. And I don't care.
Jesus. Wow.
I roll my eyes at his second wow. I'm so not in the mood for his incredulity. Not when I'm damn sure he's going to drop this cold as soon as he knows what I'm about to do. I'm going to Austin. If question marks were audible, I'd have just heard one from his end. That's where he is, just south of Austin.
So you're going to go to Austin to... what?
Suspicion laces his tone, not so glib now, like he's finally getting it. I told Catherine and Bethany Shank that this trip was part responsibility, part curiosity, but that was stretching the truth. This child I've never seen or held exerts a deep, gravitational sort of draw. Against all odds, I feel a bond between us that has for 4 years surfaced on his birthday only. It isn't mere curiosity pulling me to Texas, and I know it. I'm going to check on his situation. I'm going to find out if I can get him back. Silence. Dead silence. I wish I could reclaim the words and leave them unsaid. It figures that Reed would be the one I blurt the whole truth to.
Brooke, the kid's not a pair of Lumva slingbacks. You can't just put in an order at Barney's and pick him up later. You gave up your rights to him. He can be adopted by someone else now, right? You gave him away.
I know that, Reed. Don't you think I fucking know that? I hate that he put it that way. Gave him away. As if I sacrificed nothing to do it. And traipsed off scot-free like he did.
Yeah. Okay. But no one's going to let you disrupt his life now just to...
Disrupt his life? He's in foster care and I'm his mother. More silence. And I think I'm as stunned as he is by my declaration. It's clear that he doesn't feel the same obligation I feel, but this has never been his burden. It has only ever been mine. His 12-step apology, no matter what it stems from, doesn't extend that far. Look, I don't expect you to be involved or anything, okay? I didn't claim that you were his father 4.5 years ago, and I won't now. Not that there might not be some media speculation.
Brooke, you can't seriously mean to go to Austin and bring him back to L.A.? What about your career? Or the fact that you're 20 and single?
I should have known he wouldn't understand. What? Like there's no such thing as a single mother? Besides which, I can't think that far ahead right now. All I know is he needs me, and I'm going, and I don't give a shit who thinks what about it, including you. Just deny you're his father if it comes to that. I'm sure Graham and Emma won't tell, and they're the only ones who know. I have to go now. Later, Reed. I press end and toss the phone onto the bed. I still hate saying Graham's name or thinking about him. I press my fingers to my sternum hard because it hurts. It always hurts when I think about him. The weather in Austin is close to that of Los Angeles this time of year, though it's a bit more volatile. I roll up a jacket and cram it alongside the jeans. And then I stop dead, thinking about River. He'll need clothes, and toys, and soap, and whatever else kids his age need. Special food? A nanny? I have no idea. I have no idea. The enormity of this decision swirls around me and fills the room, insinuating that I can't possibly do this. I'm going to fail. One way or another, I'm going to fail. I've heard those same sorts of prophecies inside my own head my entire life, and I learned long ago to ignore them. At 15, I decided to become a movie star, and now I am. I run my career and my personal life as I see fit, and no one tells me what to do. I screw up occasionally, like I did with Graham. That failure cost me my best friend, and I'll never come to terms with it. Damn it, I mutter, yanking the second case from the bed and shoving Graham Douglas from my mind again. If I get to Austin and believe there's a viable alternative to me taking my son back, I'll consider it. Otherwise, I'm just going to have to figure this single-parent shit out.
Reed. Shit. Shit, shit, shit. Tonight, Dory and I have our first public date. We have literally days until she leaves for Berkeley, which is an ass-numbingly boring 5-hour drive from L.A. The last thing I want to do is drop, "Oh, by the way, I'm a father," sort of on her right before she goes. The longer I don't tell her, the worse it becomes that I haven't. Unless she never finds out. The probability of Brooke actually bringing the kid home with her like he's a puppy from the pound is doubtful. Aside from the legal implications of her having relinquished her rights to him, there's a simple fact that Brooke Cameron doesn't voluntarily interact with children. Even Graham's kids seemed like no more than a means to an end to her, an inconvenience she knew she'd have to tolerate to be with him. She's got a younger half-brother, I think, born after we split, but I've never seen a single photo of her with him. Although that could have as much to do with avoidance of her father, whom she loathes. Would Dory do that for me? Though I don't plan to claim paternity publicly, no matter what I plead guilty to privately. Christ, I can't even go there right now. Dory was abandoned by that guy in high school, and on the surface, what happened between Brooke and me looks no different. Except that Brooke told me she was pregnant, and then I abandoned her. Fuck, if I was religious, I would cross myself. Life was so much easier before I had a conscience. Brooke has complete control over what happens now, and I'm never fond of that scenario. She's volatile and impulsive, not a safe combination, though she said she wouldn't tell. Graham and Emma aren't going to out me either, though I can just imagine their united disapproval if I happen to run into them. Once I find out what Brooke plans to do, I'll tell Dory. Or not. Good plan. Dory. What are we doing? A hint, please. Or just tell me. I don't know what to wear. Me. A casual dinner, then a party at my friend John's place. Dory. A party. Me. That's not a big deal. If you don't want to go, we don't have to. Dory, no, if this is how you want to do it, then let's do it. What should I wear? Me. Whatever you want. Dory, you always say that. Me. And I always mean it.
Chapter 5. Dory. There's been no change in my sister in the 5 months since her accident. And according to her prognosis, none is expected. Locked in a persistent vegetative state, she continues to exist, but nothing more. My parents finally stopped asking God for a miracle with every dinner table prayer, so I no longer have to bite back words that keep my stomach twisted into knots. Now they simply request God's care of her, a prayer that still swells from the last traces of faith in my heart, even as I deem it incompatible with the fact that she's in this condition at all. I'm spending time with Deb this afternoon, killing time before meeting Kayla and Amy for another of their Cinderella transformations. While trimming the stems of the tulips I picked up on the way over, I relay the latest developments in my life. I'm getting better, but these one-sided conversations still feel contrived. When Mom, Dad, or Nick comes with me, I'm silent except for replies to something they say. I'll stroke Deb's arm, help feed her, sing her favorite songs, brush her hair. But I only speak to her when we're alone, like we are now. I'm going out to dinner with Reed tonight, I tell her, followed by the clip-clip of my scissors pruning an inch from each stem. The day after Reed's return to my life just days ago, I'd confided the truth of our newfound relationship into Deb's silent room. I felt like such a coward, confessing secrets to my mute, unresponsive sister and no one else. Now my parents are aware of it, but their biased judgment of Reed means my sharing stops there. Deb, once again, is my confidant. What I would give for her fair-minded advice instead of this silence. I don't know what she'd think of Reed or our relationship, but she would tell me straight up, without any candy coating. And in the end, she'd support whatever decision I made. Instead, I hear only the views of distraught parents and celebrity-awed friends. Neither feels credible. We're also going to a party. Crazy, right? Me at a Hollywood party. His friend John isn't a celebrity, but he sounds like sort of a social climber. A sobering thought hits me then, as if Deb had stated it. I guess I shouldn't judge, though. Most people are going to think the same of me. Or worse, gold digger. I straighten the soft blanket on Deb's bed and perch next to her. I have no idea what to wear tonight. So I invited Kayla and Amy to come over and do their worst. Laughing softly, I recall my friends' doubly silent response when I phoned to tell them about Reed and our impending debut. I don't think I've ever known either of them to be stunned into silence, certainly not both of them at the same time. 5 seconds later, they erupted into a breakneck dialogue about designers, color palettes, shoe trends, and hairstyles, and all the reasons I'd been reluctant to tell them came rushing back. The last time I'd allowed them free rein with my clothes and makeup, I'd woken up in Reed's bed with the worst hangover imaginable. There were worse alternatives than that, though, one of which almost happened. I almost left a nightclub with a possibly psychotic stranger due to my alcohol-compromised state. Instead, I woke up to the beginnings of a fairy tale love. One I still can't quite believe is real. After arguing with each other for 10 minutes as though I'm not standing there, Amy and Kayla settle for a turquoise silk top with beading around the hem and neckline, Kayla's, a pair of dark, pressed jeans in an unfamiliar brand, Amy's, and fuzzy chocolate boots, also Amy's, and flat-heeled, thank the Lord. Naturally, they refuse to consider any of my clothing for more than half a second. No, Amy says. No, you should never wear your clothes when you go out with him. I'm not kidding. Never. I decide to panic about that later. Right now, I don't have time. Trying to talk Kayla out of using her mammoth case of cosmetics on me is futile. But we compromise with a semi-natural look when I remind her that Reed has only ever seen me with next to no makeup. Except for the hangover night, I add, and they both avert their eyes, each reproached for letting me out of her sight at that club. You guys, stop with the guilty faces. They peer back at me, sheepish, and I shake my head, insisting, I made my own foolish decisions that night. I got luckier than I deserved when Reed spotted me. I don't blame you, and I never did. I'm just not used to a lot of makeup, and I want to feel comfortable tonight. Did I just say comfortable? What a totally unrealistic request. Did you notice how she just went, Reed, like you'd say Clark or Josh? Amy asks Kayla, who nods. They both sigh, and I struggle to resist an eye roll. From the moment Amy and Kayla arrived, and even when Reed arrives to pick me up, Mom is conspicuously absent. She vanished behind my parents' closed bedroom door before I came home from Deb's and hasn't come out. Dad does his fatherly duty, opening the door and uttering his unfailingly polite, if clipped,
Good evening, Reed.
I hear Reed's response as I reach the top of the stairs, Kayla and Amy at my heels.
Good evening, Mr. Cantrell. Reverend Cantrell,
my father corrects, not meanly, but not in the playful manner in which he'd have spoken to Nick, whom he directed, call me Doug.
Reverend Cantrell,
Reed parrots, unfazed, releasing my father's hand as I come into view. I soak in the sight of him, despite having seen him yesterday. His blue button-down and jeans seem understated, but I'd bet $20 he knows exactly what wearing that particular shade of blue does to his eyes. I'll be lucky if Kayla doesn't press so close to my back that I end up in a heap at the bottom of the staircase.
Amy, she squeaks, that's really him.
Reed's eyes sweep over me from head to toe and back, unhurriedly, with no care of his rapt audience, my father or either of my star-struck friends.
Beautiful,
he
says,
taking my hand. And I'm immediately thankful for my friends and their fairy godmother skills.
Reed. Ready? I ask her, and it won't be the last time tonight I do so. We're in a short line of cars waiting for the valet. Unhooking her seatbelt, she takes a deep breath and squares her shoulders, as if she's preparing for a challenging Olympic performance instead of a night out. Her huge brown eyes turn to me as she nods, Ready. I suppress a laugh and lean to kiss her temple. This will all be over soon, and will be old news, I promise. These words have a 50-50 chance of becoming truth. Same chance of turning out to be entirely false, but I prefer to be optimistic about my promises. Okay, she says, so very serious and trusting. Which is why tonight I chose one of the places celebrities go when we want to feel a bit like ordinary people. Ordinary, wealthy people who don't have to endure being photographed everywhere they go. Chateau Marmont. Paparazzi aren't allowed into the long bricked drive, let alone up the steps or inside. Cameras are completely prohibited in the restaurant. In fact, and unlike some Hollywood spots, that decree is strictly enforced. Not that obsessive fans don't ever break the rules and get away with it, but dinner on the patio is a dark, candlelit affair. Good luck getting off a perfect shot with a cell phone and no flash. The valet exchanges keys and a ticket with the driver in front of us, and I slide my fingers down Dory's arm, taking her hand. Have you been here before? She laughs as though that's the most ridiculous question ever posed. No. I've heard about it, though. Does that count? I'll allow half a point for knowledge of it. Sounds like we might need to schedule a weekend in the penthouse, though. Or maybe you'd prefer one of the cottages. She smiles up at me. A cottage? Of course she'd be more intrigued by a creaky, cloistered 1930s bungalow than a sumptuous, high-ceilinged suite with patio views of Sunset Boulevard and the West Hollywood hillside. That sounds like a storybook suggestion. Should I bring my red hoodie and a picnic basket? Only if you're gonna say, oh, Reed, what a big... Stop! She laughs, pressing her hand to my mouth. Don't you dare finish that thought. I run a finger over the curve of her ear, knowing it would be bright pink if I could discern the color in the dim confines of the car. Well, I'm afraid it's too late for that. Adorably prim, she purses her lips and changes the subject. Staying at a hotel in the city where you live seems like an impractical thing to do, though I guess that's normal for celebrities. You've never done that? My last NLA hotel stay was a Brooks insistence. When her whole convoluted plan to lure Graham away from Emma blew up in her face. Dory shrugs lightly, glancing forward as I pull up to the valet stand and remember that her high school jerk of a boyfriend took her to a motel when she turned 15, and then dumped her a month later, when he turned 18 and she became jailbait. I'd like to beat the shit out of that guy, even if it has been nearly 4 years. Looks like I have a new goal. Teach Dory to be impractical. She shakes her head, bemused. I don't know, Reed. That sounds like an unattainable goal. The valet opens her door and she starts before taking another deep breath and accepting his hand. She's a bundle of nerves. I doubt she's going to relax all evening, and God knows I probably won't be able to talk her into loosening up the Reed Alexander way, with a shot of something old and expensive. Challenge accepted, Dorcas Cantrell, I murmur, jumping out of my side of the car and coming around to encircle her shoulders and lead her inside. Challenge accepted. I ordered the chilled crab and avocado for an appetizer, and a bottle of Torontes. Dory asks for a glass of water. At my nod, the waiter fetches a trendy bottled water, decanting and pouring it into her glass while maintaining a perfectly blank expression. Dory arches a brow and mouths impractical at me with a smirk. I smirk back. She has no idea what impractical things I can come up with where she's concerned. By the end of the meal, she's more relaxed. Despite the crush of people, the lush vegetation and flickering candles render the patio cozy and intimate instead of congested. There've been no camera flashes, of course, and no one's paid us any particular attention other than the waitstaff, all of them serving us with the same pleasant but impassive expressions. It won't be this way in other L.A. haunts. At some point soon, Dory will be fully initiated into the public scrutiny that comes with being or dating a celebrity. She had a minor taste of it last summer, after the patio incident, but that was nothing. Not that I'm telling her that. John's high-rise apartment is bursting at the seams by the time we arrive, which wasn't exactly what we agreed on when he begged me to let him host Dory's coming-out party. Another thing I'm not telling her, that John and I devised the party specifically to introduce her to our crowd in a less public venue. Wow, Dory murmurs, leaning close. Your friend has lots of friends. John doesn't have friends as much as he has a network of useful acquaintances, and those acquaintances are all not so slyly eyeballing us the moment we hand our jackets to the girl at the door and begin to make our way through the crowd. I follow the sound of John's laughter over the music, feeling Dory's hand clamped to mine like our palms are permanently bonded. Reed! Hey, dude! Where's... Oh, there she is, he smiles, spotting her behind me. Even smaller than I remembered. Dory has only the vaguest of memories of John since their only meeting occurred during the most inebriated night of her life, if not the only inebriated night of her life. She smiles back at him, but her grip on my hand doesn't loosen. I bend that arm behind her back so I can pull her closer. She may be curvy and strong, but John's right. She feels small tucked to my side. Hey, John. Lots of people here, I say pointedly. We'd agreed on 20 or so, and there's easily 2 or 3 times that many wandering around his place and spilling onto the balcony. He shrugs and grins. What can I say? I'm a popular guy. Snatching 2 champagne flutes from the bar's countertop, he hands them to us. Welcome, Dory. I hear you've made an honest man of my bro here. I take 1 glass while Dory shakes her head infinitesimally. Oh, I don't... Deftly separating her from me, John smiles and leans close, pressing the glass into her hand. Just hold it. You can sip it, or not. His hand at her lower back, he says over his shoulder. I'll return her in a bit, dude. Maybe. His brows waggle and I glare at him. John, my voice has an edge, but he's set on ignoring me, damn him. Stopping at the first huddle of people, he asks, Claude and Nicole, have you met Reed's girlfriend? This is Dory, L.A. native, Cal undergrad, way too smart for him. I'm just waiting for her to wise up so I can swoop in. Eyebrows rise, eyes widen, and a couple of mouths fall open. I hear my name whispered, along with the repetition of the word girlfriend and speculations of, who is she? John is strategically blocking Dory's view of a couple of girls whose eyes run over her, one whispering to the other, their joint scorn palpable. I'm pretty sure I've slept with at least one of them. Shit. The couple he addressed, though, smile and recover quickly. They're both semi-working actors, each patiently awaiting a turn in the spotlight, and it's standard John to keep his eye on up-and-comers like that. Just as he did with me. Oh, Dory, so nice to meet you, Nicole says. Thank you, Dory smiles, holding that glass of champagne like an ornamental shield. John's still got her opposite arm tucked into the crook of his elbow. I didn't know Reed had a girlfriend, Claude says, addressing her with curiosity. This is recent? Not only recent, but virtually unprecedented, John answers, proud to be the one to divulge this newsflash. As he escorts her to the next group, she throws an amused glance over her shoulder, and I'm convinced she can handle just about anything.
Chapter 6. Brooke. Catherine offered to drive in and pick me up, but the flight is due to land close to midnight, and I have a downtown appointment at 9 a.m. There's no reason to trek out to the sticks just to turn around in a few hours and come right back, in rush hour traffic, no less. I set up car service and a hotel with an open-ended checkout instead, something my agent or manager would normally do, but I'm not even telling either of them I'm leaving L.A., let alone the reason why. They'd freak out and blow up my phone with all the reasons I shouldn't go. What's that thing they say about apologizing later instead of asking permission now? That could be the official Brooke Cameron motto. My favorite part of flying first class is that I'm first on and first off, which means little to no interaction with my fellow passengers. That's a luxury I'm happy to pay for. Tonight, my roommate is some musician's kid. I vaguely recognize him, but can't recall which legendary lead man whore fathered him. He ogles me with interest, but I'm not sure if he recognizes me. I check him out while he's engrossed in an argument with the flight attendant over whether or not he can be served alcohol. But this is first class, he whines, as if she isn't aware of that. And my short perusal leads to the conclusion that he can't be a day over 16. I slip my earbuds in, stare out the window, and ignore him. Soon he's playing an all-boobs-and-blood video game on his laptop, confirming his probable age. By the time we land, all the airport shops are closed and the linked seating outside every gate is empty, the wide expanse of polished floor reflecting the methodical dots of yellow lighting in the main concourse. A large metal sign under a colorful collection of guitar art declares my hometown the music capital of the world. Pieces of this collection stand watch over empty baggage carousels, all but one of them motionless, probably my flight. I didn't check a bag, so I don't have to stop. I'm creeped out in such a huge, nearly unpopulated place, and my absurd imagination, courtesy 2 hours worth of gory video game imagery, suggests a zombie apocalypse. I hightail it through the nearly deserted airport to the appointed exit, where a car waits at the curb to transport me into the city I used to know so well. I've only been back 3 times in the past 6 years. The first to give birth to River, the second to film School Pride, and the third to do a photo shoot promoting the film. Austin and I have grown and changed since I lived here, whether we welcomed those transformations or not. I might be able to retrace my steps, but I can't go back and choose an alternate path. Far too late for that. I was 15 when I went on location without parental supervision for the first time. Reed, a year younger, was the only cast member near my age. As minor characters, we had few scenes and were too often left to our own devices. We quickly formed an alliance against being bored out of our minds. One afternoon during the first week, I sat on my trailer steps and watched as he attempted to perform a routine trick on the longboard he'd brought along. Over and over, he glided across the concrete, hooking the edge of the board and jumping simultaneously, but never quite landing it. He was so pretty, so cocky, so determined. So doing it wrong. The fifth time he screwed up, he fell on his ass and I chuckled. Scowling, he swiped blood from his elbow and dared,
"Why don't you try it if you think it looks so easy?"
I didn't tell him that my stepsister, Kylie, was a skilled skateboarder, and I'd known how to pop shove it like a pro since I was 10. Pretending ignorance, I listened as he explained the how-to. When I got a running start before jumping onto the board and pumping it even faster, he looked startled. With a practiced flick of my foot, I flipped the board, landed it smoothly, and glided by him wearing a cocky grin of my own. As he walked up, I stepped off the board and popped it up and into my hand to give it back. Placing his hand atop mine instead of taking the board, he pushed right into my personal space, eyes bright.
"That was awesome," he said, "and so freaking hot, it makes me want to, like, kiss you or something."
"Okay," I said, heart pounding from the physical exertion, the anticipation of my first kiss or both. If he was surprised by my instant acquiescence, he didn't show it. Instead, he stepped closer, bracketed my waist with his hands, and leaned to give me a kiss that was more like several small kisses in a row, each one better than the last. I didn't know then that he was experiencing his first kiss, too. And his second. And his third. Dory. The farther I get from Reed, the more anxious I am. I don't know any of these people, and I don't know this roguish boy guiding me through the crowd with his hand at my lower back, either. I know he's Reed's best friend, but any time Reed tries to describe their relationship, he ends up shaking his head and shrugging.
"You'll see when you meet him. He's just... John."
So far, I've concluded that John is a habitual flirt and a shameless celebrity suck-up, and his language is as atrocious as Reed's was, or more likely, as atrocious as Reed's is. I have no delusions that I've changed him, only that he attempts to abide by my limits when he's around me. Judging by tonight's spate of accolades concerning my education and social service record, John is also determined to get on my good side. Or elevate me to sainthood by the end of the night. I clear my throat to correct the erroneous statement he's just made to a couple of girls lounging on his sofa, girls who are now appraising me curiously, as if I have extra limbs or a blue skin tone. "I'm not actually a missionary." He frowns.
"But Reed said you went to Puerto Rico or Brazil to hand out shoes or Bibles or something."
I went to Ecuador to work as a volunteer music teacher at a mission school.
"Mission school, right. So you're like a missionary."
"Oh, my word." I take a breath. "Well, no. Missionaries usually accept long-term or even lifelong assignments. They're dedicated to doing evangelical work as well as practical objectives like establishing schools or hospitals."
"But you just said you were helping run a school in Panama."
I sigh, recalling Ana Diaz, my program director in Quito, who fights a daily, year-round battle against poverty, crime, and uneducated parents who can't imagine anything better for their children, who send them out to shine shoes or pickpocket or anything that might put food on the family's table that night. "She said Ecuador," one of the girls says, scrutinizing my face. "Like all the other girls here, she's dressed casually, but something about the way the fabrics drape over her says money. Her eyes are dark and alert. I'm certain she can tell that I'm completely out of my element." John shrugs.
"Potato, potato."
She rolls her eyes and mutters, "Idiot." John feigns an insulted gasp, voicing his unconcern over her opinion wordlessly. Ignoring him, she asks, "So you're Reed's girlfriend?" My heart flips over at the word, and I nod, absorbing the disbelief in her crooked brow and swiftly repeated head-to-toe inspection. "I'm sorry, it's just... you seem really... not his type." I flush and John turns to me, saying,
"No need to be a bitch, Jo..."
"No," she leans forward. "I mean, she's totally unlike his last girlfriend." John stops, turning back to her.
"I know you don't know Emma Pierce."
"Not her. Her lip angles in a sneer of disgust. Brooke Cameron. My mouth falls open.
Brooke Cameron.
The beautiful star of Life's a Beach, with whom Kayla and Amy have a love and hate from afar relationship. The girl who played Caroline in Reed's last movie, she was once his girlfriend?
Jesus, that flaming disaster was like 100 years ago, and you remember it?
John laughs.
Obsessed much?
Fuck you, John, Joe says, surging up, eyes flashing, drink sloshing onto her hand. I'm not the one content to be his man-whore sidekick. No offense, she tosses at me. I glance over my shoulder, looking for Reed and fighting claustrophobia.
God! Okay, you two, that's enough.
The other girl pipes up, her voice as tiny as she is. She stands, hands on hips, glowering up at John.
I thought you were going to be nice.
He pulls her in close with his opposite arm.
Maybe you should keep your roommate on a leash, Bianca. Or muzzled.
John!
She shoves him in the chest half-heartedly, the attraction between them obvious.
Come on, Bianca.
Joe stomps toward the bar set up in the corner. Bianca heaves a groan, shakes her head, and follows her friend. Watching them go, lips flattened, John mumbles,
Well, that was nasty.
Is Bianca your... I stop, unsure how to classify her. He takes the fluted glass from my hand, quaffs half the bubbly contents, champagne, I assume, and hands it back.
We're on again, off again. Can't stand her charming roommate, though, in case you didn't catch that.
I hadn't noticed. He smiles wolfishly at my sarcastic tone, and I begin to see the place where he and Reed connect.
I like you, Dory. Hey.
Reed's eyes are dark, one brow quirked as he draws me from John's side.
Hands off, man. I don't want to maim you at your own party.
His threat is all for show, as is John's theatrical palms up. Reed's voice goes softer, and he angles his head in the direction taken by the girls.
And, what was that about? Why is Joe even here?
Bro, seriously, be realistic, John scoffs. I can't just invite a bunch of guys.
The implication is unmistakable. There's no avoiding some things, like the ghosts of Reed's sexual past. There are too many girls in his social circle, in this city, in this country, for us to avoid them all. His Hollywood Lothario reputation precedes him. My friends and even my parents are all too familiar with it. I've made it clear that I don't want or need to hear the grisly details, and I think he was grateful he didn't have to confess them. I expect the general public to wonder what in the world he's doing with me. I got a taste of that when I tripped and fell on top of him at the Habitat Project last summer, sending the tabloids into merciless speculation. I expect to run into starlets and fans who want him, who've been with him, even, who might hate me on sight. Pretty sure Joe is one of those. But finding out that he was involved with Brooke Cameron for long enough that it was a known relationship, he may have loved her. That unforeseen possibility wells up, a reflux of the only fear I've refused to face. Despite the rumors that he's bedded half of young Hollywood, and the fact that he's never refuted those allegations, I hoped his heart was mine alone. I want to reject the jealousy and insecurity that begins to boil in the pit of my stomach. I need the truth, whatever it is, but I can't ask him. Because deep inside, I don't want to know. Chapter 7. Brooke. Norman Rogers, Catherine's attorney, more of a family friend at this point since he's been her attorney since her divorce from my dad, sputters, incredulous, when I tell him I want River.
But are you sure?
He asks, as if I would set up this appointment and travel from Los Angeles to Texas on a whim. I grind my teeth. I survived the shocked reactions of Reed, my private investigator, and my stepmother. What's one more? Yes. I want my son back. On second thought, I should probably get used to this response. Maybe I should call Angelina and ask her how she fielded these sorts of skeptical reactions. Eyeing me over his glasses, Norman says,
All righty then.
Tapping his gold-plated pen on the pad, he gets down to business.
The first thing we need to do is get in front of a judge and get a home study ordered. I assume you plan to move him to California? If so, we'll need to get an ICPC to coordinate the case between Los Angeles County and the state of Texas.
He scrawls his lawyer chicken scratch across a legal pad, plotting our plan of attack, I assume.
It'll be up to the judge whether the adoption takes place here in Texas or is transferred to a California court.
Adoption? I throw some incredulity of my own at him. But I'm his mother. Can't I just have him back? Norman stares down at the pad and underlines a couple of things, rubbing one thick finger back and forth on his forehead as if he's trying to buff away the premature creases this conversation will leave there. The silence stretches until at last he clears his throat.
Brooke, River is in foster care. The state of Texas holds guardianship over him. There are specific procedures in place to make sure what's done now is in the best interest of the child.
But I'm his mother, I whisper, repeating myself, the guilt swallowing me up like quicksand. I can barely breathe.
Technically, Brooke, you aren't.
This statement slaps me in the face, stealing the remainder of my breath. I feel my mouth fall open and watch Norman's brows draw together in contrition, his lips tightening. He's given me the blunt truth, and as much as I appreciate him doing so, I didn't anticipate this answer.
How long? How long until I can have him?
A tremor runs through my entire body, starting at my neck and shooting painfully to the tips of my fingers and toes.
Or are you telling me I can't get him back?
Norman's rueful expression blurs while the rest of the room swims.
Brooke, you gave him up when he was born because you believed that to be in his best interest.
I seal my shuddering lips together.
I gave him up because I didn't want him. I didn't even want to hold him before I gave him away. My relinquishment was no selfless act on my part. I just wanted my life back.
The court will take that into consideration,
he continues. Overriding my buzzing thoughts, his voice is tinny, as though his words echo through a can.
Best case scenario, we're looking at 4 or 5 months.
4 or 5 months?
My words resound and twang, and I don't care who hears or how I sound. I can't leave him in that dirty, flea-infested place for months.
I can't just go back home and leave him here like I did last time.
Like explosives detonating a dam, something cracks inside my chest, and to my utter horror, I'm bawling. Norman stands and sits, twice, finally seizing a box of tissues from his tidy credenza and thrusting it at me as Catherine bursts into the room, dropping into the chair next to me and pulling me to her shoulder.
Honey, you aren't abandoning him. We're starting a process here. Look, we want them to be meticulous. We want them to be careful. We don't know if there are grandparents who want him, or aunts or uncles who've already started this process. Maybe he's weeks or days away from a new home.
She knew. That's why she insisted on coming along today. And why she installed herself in a chair right outside the office door. That's why she was so restrained this morning on the drive from the hotel, venturing no opinions about what Norman might say. She already knew, or at least suspected.
You want what's best for him, right?
She asks. I nod and bury my face against her like I had as a child. How many times had I come to her when my own parents failed me? She'd kept me sane when no one else cared what I thought, felt, or wanted. But if River has grandparents or aunts or uncles, where the hell were those people when he was suffering? And where was I? Partying?
or shooting another insipid Life's a Beach episode? A second wave of sobs washes over me, but I steel myself against it like a sharp high face of rock against the tide. What's best for my son is me. As if I'd said these words aloud, Catherine says, Even if what's best for him might not be coming home with you right now? Even if what's best for him isn't you? Catherine's words light the landscape of my memory. Graham. The loss of his friendship and that sharp, buried pain in the center of my chest. I thought I was what was best for him. But really, I hadn't cared what was best for him. I'd wanted Graham because Graham would have been best for me. I still believe that, though I see now, more clearly than ever, that I was not best for him. I wasn't what he wanted. I want to be what's best for River, but what if I'm not? I pull myself together, breathe, sit up straight, press the tissue tight under each eye, clear my throat. Yes.
Read. No paparazzi shots emerge, but one shadowy fan-submitted cell phone image pops up on one of my fan sites. And within the hour, it's on all of them, as is speculation about Dory. John texts me the link. John, word is out on your super-secret GF, me. Is it okay to murder some of these people? What makes them think their stupid opinions about who I date matters to me? John, come on, dude, you've seen this a million times before. Literally. Me, I know. I just feel more protective of her. John, aware. Me, yeah, yeah, I'd say I'm sorry, but I'm not. John, are you getting her a bodyguard? Me. I hadn't thought of that. God, she would freak. Can I do that without her knowing? John. Probably, but then she can't tell him who's safe. He might beat up some poor fucker who's just talking to her. Me. Then that would be bad. Right? John. Sounds like a question for lawyer dad. When I show up for our second public date, I'm greeted by the sight of the media camped out along Dory's street. Not many, but enough to rattle Dory and her parents. A rental van sits in the driveway, backed up to the garage and probably already loaded. Her parents are driving her upstate to Berkeley tomorrow, and I'm not invited. They've always assumed they'd take me to college, move me into my dorm, meet my roommate, suffer through the tearful goodbyes, all that stuff. Just the three of us, she told me. I don't expect to be part of every segment of her life, but I feel like I'm in a tug-of-war with them. Consenting to assume second place is not in my nature, and chucking her parents' wishes out the window isn't in Dory's. The current stalemate is a fucked-up sort of compromise, but at this point, whatever works, works. How much do you trust me? I ask just before we head out her front door. She looks up at me, a little less made up than she was last time we went out. Her friends aren't here tonight. Her outfit, pale pink button-down shirt, gray cords and generic loafers in a nondescript color, is less hip, a more girl next door than her previous, no doubt borrowed ensemble. As happened with her collection of extra-large, philanthropical, mindful T-shirts, though, it turns me on knowing that I'm the guy who knows what's underneath her plain veneer. Do you need to ask? She says, I'm still getting used to it. I trust you, Reed. Subduing a brief surge of guilt over the rather significant thing I'm still withholding, I tell her, I'm going to hold your hand on the way to the car, which will be interpreted, correctly, as deliberate confirmation of our relationship. Try to erase that apprehensive little frown. Have you ever been on stage? School play? Class skit? Anything? She nods, the crease between her brows more pronounced and her lower lip drawn fully into her mouth. Firm evidence of her anxiety. I've done my share of class skits. Why? Don't panic. I'm not giving you any lines. You just need to try to look happy. The frown deepens. I am happy. I can't help but laugh. Very convincing, Miss Cantrell. I trace a little furrow with my index finger, continuing down her nose and gently pinching her chin between my fingertips. She takes a slow breath, closes her eyes, and relaxes her face into my hand. Rewarding her with a deep kiss, my thumb strokes her cheek. Perfect. Now hold that satisfied expression, and later this evening, I'll make good on the promise behind that kiss. Before she can lose her nerve, I take her hand and we emerge into the first real shitstorm of paparazzi she's been subjected to. They call our names in a barrage of questions. Reed, are you and Miss Cantrell in a relationship now? And how long have you two been together? While cameras whir and flashes erupt into the violet twilight, she's never squeezed my hand so tightly. Making certain she's safely locked in before circling the back of my car to the driver's door, I open the door and flash the photogs a smile. A show of gratitude that they left us enough room to maneuver from the front door to the car. What about Emma Pierce? A voice calls. Does this mean you're over her? Moving on? I shake my head and chuckle. Man, they just do not give up. It's been 8 months since I delivered Emma right into Graham Douglas's arms. When I met up with the two of them in Vancouver last fall, they were revoltingly happy. But seeing the two of them together then only made me think of Dory, the infuriating habitat girl I